We are live. This is Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlisle, joined as always by my esteemed co-host, yes, Jake Taylor. Our special guest today is Spencer Jacob. He's the editor of the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street, and he's got a book out. He's talking to us about GameStop, Roaring Kitty. How are you, Spencer? Good to see you.
I'm good. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you guys.
Welcome.
So the book is called The Revolution That Wasn't. Why is it called The Revolution
Spoiler
That
alert.
Wasn't?
Hold on.
You told us how it ended.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I failed book marketing 101 with that one, or the editors at Penguin Random House did. I mean, if it wasn't, then why am I reading this? But I mean, that describes how this event was perceived and what it wasn't, which it wasn't a revolution. You know, if you journalists are accused of sort of, you know, getting carried away with things, and they also said that we write the first draft of history, and the first draft was not really correct in this case. I mean, the 80 to 90% of the kind of breathless coverage of that initial meme stock squeeze was that they had turned the tables on Wall Street, that the things would always be different, that social media had changed the way things work, and that Wall Street had been given a black eye. And that just is not the case at all. I think every mania tends to extract wealth from the masses and transfer at least some of that wealth to Wall Street writ large. And this one did too. And that's something that people continue to not understand or don't want to understand about this episode. It's a fascinating story. It's interesting for many, many reasons. And, you know, I hesitate to say that some financial episode was different than all the ones that came before it, but so many things had to happen for this meme stock squeeze to occur. And so it was a real moment in history, financially and just generally in history. But it wasn't a revolution, and that's, you know, in that sense, the title is correct. It's just not maybe not marketing pixie dust.
So there were some very high profile scalps, though. Melvin Capital. Yeah. Melvin Capital seems to have been taken down by GameStop, at least.
For sure. Yes. I mean, they're. You know, investing to some extent is a zero sum game, right? And they got zeroed out almost. I mean, they lost close to $7 billion, this previously very successful hedge fund, and there were other people who got blown up on Wall Street. So I'm not saying that there weren't some very substantial losses as a result of the meme stock squeeze and GameStop mania. What I'm saying is that Wall Street is comprised of lots of different people, and most of the money on Wall Street is earned through fee income, through processing transactions, and, you know, just kind of holding other people's money. And, you know, the writ large, Wall Street made a ton of money in the run-up to this event, during the event, and following it, because you had all these young people, and it was mainly young people, rush into the market with their money and lose lots of it. And even if they individually didn't all lose money, because many people did make money or on paper are still sitting on gains, it was a very profitable event for Wall Street and for corporate insiders also, which is something people forget. You know, people who just were really in the right place at the right time, had some stock options, were sitting on the board of, or in the C-suite of these companies that were kind of slowly going down the tubes, and all of a sudden lightning struck and they walked away with a lot of money when they didn't expect to.
Yeah. Where did the little investors end up losing money? I mean, they just kept overpaying for shares of GameStop, let's say, mm-hmm. or was it options that ended up going to, you know, expiring at zero?
Well, I mean, the whole episode really, if you want to kind of get back to its origins, begins in the, you know, with the pandemic, which emerged about a year earlier, not quite a year earlier. Every brokerage in late 2019 went to zero commissions in the United States. Then in early 2020, you had the pandemic, and you just had a rush of young people. More than 10 million accounts opened. mainly places like Robinhood, but also E-Trade, Fidelity, Schwab, eToro, what have you. A bunch of people who previously had not been interested in finance suddenly were very interested in it. And there were many reasons for that. Part of that was just boredom. Part of that was that they had stimulus checks or other enforced savings with which they could invest. They were stuck on their phones for, you know, many hours, especially in the early part of the pandemic. Sports gambling had taken off. Suddenly all sports were off the air and they were looking for some other outlet. And we're talking really, really males between the ages of 18 and 35 were the kind of the vanguard of the group that sent GameStop to the moon. And they began doing all kinds of what you and I might consider dumb things with their money, with their investment accounts. And those dumb things turned out to be pretty profitable for a brief while. You know, if you look at, for example, ending in you know the month of the GameStop squeeze and beginning that March of 2020, or rather April of 2020, an index of unprofitable companies maintained by Goldman Sachs, it was up almost 300%. Yeah. So the worst stuff did the best. And, you know, you had Warren Buffett, who's obviously has a fantastic long-term track record, being spooked out of airlines. He dumped airlines close to the bottom. And, you know, in terms of managing risk, probably it was the right move. In hindsight, it wasn't the right move. You know, you had an index of airline stocks jumping almost 100% in the following 3 months. So all the things that people who their parents and grandparents may have respected, the kind of the talking heads on wise gray hairs saying you should and shouldn't do, doing the opposite was very, very profitable. And you had a bunch of new influencers emerging on the scene and telling people to buy Hertz because it, you know, even though it was bankrupt.
Yeah.
And it was basically everyone agreed, and it wound up actually making money, but everyone agreed it was worthless. And people plowed into Hertz, doubled or quadrupled their money in a matter of days. And all these reckless things made a lot of money. And the peak of that was GameStop mania. So I guess I'm not talking specifically about GameStop. GameStop went from a $4 stock prior to the pandemic to as low as being a $2 stock to being a $4 stock, call it the summer of 2020, when things started to percolate, to a $483 stock. There are some people who made money, and it's still, you know, adjusting for splits and things like that, it's still above where it was for various complicated reasons. Some of them just purely psychological, not financial, because it's continued to lose money. It's been through, I guess now 7 CEOs since our story begins, has not made a penny of profit, you know, but is the stock price is higher. So I guess if you bought early in the mania and then held on, and that was part of the ethos, was just holding on and never selling, you're still up. Certainly people who got in were very cynical and then sold at or even slightly after the peak made a ton of money. And the people, and I'm talking about the bulk of people who got involved in this, and I have 3 sons in all in the age cohort that would have been doing this, ranging now from 17 to 24, who got excited about the 17-year-old is too young to have their own brokerage account, but there were people who did it. Certainly 24-year-olds were in the sweet spot. I know that their friends were in it, and you know, some of them made money. A lot of them lost money. The people who heard about it on social media the week that this thing became a national sensation, the week that GameStop became the most traded security on planet Earth, though most of those people lost money, especially the people who saw it as a cause, who said, I'm going to put my little bit of money into this thing and I'm going to hang on and never sell because this is the way to hurt
Melvin Capital and
hurt these short sellers. They lost for sure. I mean, they're down quite a bit. So yeah, it's not a monolith. And as a group, perhaps they made money. Melvin Capital's loss was more than GameStop because anything that was a bad stock. So if you ran and he was not a pure short seller, of course, he ran a long short fund. He was net long. And he traded consumer stocks, consumer and retail stocks. You know, the rest of his portfolio also did very poorly because, you know, the things that he was long were pummeled, and the things that other stocks that he was short went through the roof. You know, nowhere in his risk management did this show up that, like, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? You're short a stock at you know, let's say I think he entered into the short position at $20, right? He was one of the first shorts that he opened. The stock went down as far as $2. He saw it going to zero, so he never closed out, and he increased his short position as it rose. What's the worst case scenario is that someone shows up and buys this for $8, for $10, right? I mean, that'd be a very bad day for you if you had a big short position in a stock, but you don't see something going to $400. There's no, you know, way that that happens. And, you know, I think that, you know, it is kind of his fault because this was being talked about openly on social media. And so what really struck me initially about this, and I sent an email to the acquisitions editor at Portfolio, which is the imprint of Penguin Random House that published my book. I said, this is a stock corner or an attempted stock corner. That has not happened for almost 100 years since the securities laws were written. And I think this is completely legal because I'm reading about this on social media and they're discussing it openly and they're discussing the most efficient way to do it, which is a gamma squeeze. They're talking about all the strategies openly and who they're going to screw over. And because it was a few hundred thousand people doing it out in the open, all documented, I don't think it was illegal at all. Whereas, you know, if you two got together and did it, discussed it over the phone and did it, you'd be getting
We'd be the Hunt brothers.
Yeah.
Spencer, just let me do some shout outs. I always like to shout out where our listeners have come in from. Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, Dubai. What's up, Samson? Brandon, Mississippi. Porto de Mos, Portugal. Congratulations. Tikva, Peter Tikva, Israel. Hope you're staying safe. Merida, Mexico, Surrey. What's up? Savonlinna, Finland. Good to see you. Copenhagen, Scotland, London. Wildwood Crest, New Jersey. Kennesaw, Georgia. Leeds, UK.
Yeah, worldwide.
Got a few more here.
There's
quite a few.
We'll do a little, get a quick little veggie segment, just short out of the way here. But the, you know, supposedly, ant eaters, you know, obviously it's in their name. They eat ants. That's their how they get sustenance. But apparently a swarm of ants can organize and swarm the ant eater so much that they actually suffocate the ant eater by, you know, crawling into its nose and breath passageway. So do you think that that's a reasonable analog of, you know, these little, you know, smaller day traders who are trying to, you know, be the little ants that are swarming the Melvin Capital anteater?
Yeah, I think that's a great, that's a kind of horrifying image in my mind right now, but I think that's actually a great analogy. I wish I had thought of, I didn't know that that could happen to anteaters, but I guess why not? Yeah, I mean, you're right, because it's a great analogy in the sense that you get your sustenance from this stuff, right? And then in a kind of a freak occurrence, you can be destroyed and die, which is what happened to Melvin Capital. And after my book came out, Melvin Capital finally kind of shut its doors and went out of business. And you think about what you do as a, well, you're a whether you're just a long only investor, but certainly if you're a long short investor, you're trying to find securities that are mispriced. And if you're long short, you're looking for securities that are mispriced on the other side, or people are just, you know, just kind of have too much hope and something's a fraud or going to go bankrupt. I mean, GameStop wasn't a fraud at any point. It just was kind of a doomed business model. And GameStop at the time that these events occur, for those not familiar with it and don't have teenage boys or sons in their young 20s, it's a place I visited a lot with them. I drove them to GameStop a lot. It's something that it takes on a special resonance for the group that led this, because they had this kind of cartoon villainish view of hedge fund managers as being evil. This is the Occupy Wall Street generation. This is a generation whose formative financial experiences before they ever had any money to invest was their parents or their parents' friends losing money, perhaps losing their homes during the global financial crisis and the housing crash. And they also grew up going to GameStop if they were men in this country. GameStop was a place where you took your old games and traded them in for new ones. And that's how they made most of their money, actually. They don't make it very much money selling you a PlayStation 5. They make, because anybody can do that and you know what the price is and you can buy it from Best Buy or buy it online. They made a lot of their money from analog games that were on cassettes or discs. People bought them, bought used ones, brought in the old ones they were no longer needed, and they got completely fleeced, as my sons did on a regular basis. And they made like 40% margins on that.
Sure.
But when a business becomes digitized, as video games did, and I know this from my sons, they would just say, I'm not going to go and buy this. I'm going to buy it online right now. It comes out at midnight, comes out at 12:01. I'm buying it at 12:01. And they'd stay up until 6 a.m. playing a game. They didn't need to go to any GameStop physical store to buy it. And it was great for the video game publishers because there's no middleman, there's no margin to give up, there's no physical media to ship, and you can't then go and trade it in and then have someone else forego paying for that physical media. It's a not completely but very heavily digitized form of entertainment. And so if you're a Blockbuster, you know, when streaming is rising, that's very bad news for you. And if you're GameStop, when digitized video games are on the rise, and you know, it's very bad news for you. And so I think Gabe Plotkin was correct in his analysis of this company kind of circling the drain. It had not made money in years, but he made a huge miscalculation. And I happen to know that people at his fund were aware that it was being written about on social media. They just didn't take it seriously. They didn't think that there was anything to worry about with these people. So this is a very long answer to your anteater analogy, but you know, he thought instead of being a $4 stock, it was a $2 or a $0 stock at best. And so there was more juice to squeeze out of it. And he failed to recognize the risk. And the risk, one part of the risk should have been very obvious to him, which is that the net short interest as a percentage of the float rose as high as 140%. Huge. You know, so that should have given him pause. If, you know, not what he read on social media, be like, okay, this is getting a little rich and I could, you know, lose a lot of money, but it's such a small position and such a large fund that I guess he thought that he could ride it out, and obviously that's not what happened.
What is funny is it was the small.
Uh-oh, Toby went into the Matrix. I have a question while Toby's getting back in. Is I'm reading still about zero, you know, day expiry that are still happening even now. Like, so is the story completely finished yet? I mean, have some other things to go here?
No, it's not. So whenever you have something, you know, let's say you read about, I'm trying not to be condescending, but this is going to sound a little bit that way. You read about, some teenagers doing some dumb prank, you know, online. You see 5 or 6 or 10 copycats of it,
right,
all over the country. And it, you know, let's say it was some epic stunt. The next 5 don't quite work out that way and often blow up into people's faces. And so this, there have been many, many echoes of this and people using some of the same tools to recreate it. And so there have been a lot of, Bed Bath & Beyond is the perfect example. You know, if you were, unless you got out, you know, you are at zero in Bed Bath & Beyond. Certainly if you bought call options, you probably lost money because you usually do lose money buying call options. But people tried to replicate, to use the techniques learned in this, which were discussed openly in the message boards, to create a gamma squeeze. And not necessarily zero day options, which are a kind of a more recent kind of development. I mean, they existed then, but the equivalent of zero day options, right? You had options that were expiring, you know, in a few days or in a week. You get the most bang for your buck if you want to make a stock go up. If it's a $5 stock and you buy a $10 strike call maturing in a week, you know, any options dealer will gladly sell you that, but does not even need to hedge at the time that they sold it to you. The chances of it being in the money are infinitesimal. You're just wasting your money. But the price of purchasing those calls is also tiny. So it's just pennies that you're losing. But that's of course part of the whole strategy. And then the more volatile stock is, the more that you know you have, you know, meme stock traders in it, the more expensive it gets. And that's why it actually got more expensive to execute these gamma squeezes later on. But as you get closer and closer to the option being the money, even if there's a very small amount of time left, the options dealers need to use their own money. They're not losing money, but they need to use their own money to purchase the stock. And there's a formula that tells them how much they have to purchase. Even when, let's say, that $10 stock is at $10.50, they're not completely hedged in the stock, but they've gone from owning none of it to owning quite a bit of it when all they received was pennies. And then they close out that position as soon as the option has expired. And so it's like a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, I know I'm stealing from Warren Buffett, who called derivatives weapons of mass destruction, but it's like a suitcase nuke or something, you know, where like, you know, you're taking something that's very small and innocuous and cheap and not very sophisticated, and you're using it to create mischief. You're not necessarily going to make money, because you're probably going to lose money. You know, your expected payoff is really low. But that's not why you did it. You did it to create mischief. And so that's something pretty new, right? That is something that did not exist before, where the whole payoff to these people was psychic. And in terms of the damage that they caused to some cartoon villain out on Wall Street who was shorting this thing, and they conflated shorting a stock with trying to destroy a company, which are two different things. Mm-hmm. They want to destroy this company that's part of your childhood. And how dare they do that? And those greedy bastards. And I remember what happened to my parents' neighbor, lost their home, and that was hedge funds too. And let's have some fun and ruin their day and cost them a few billion dollars. So it was all a lot of fun, but it wasn't for the vast majority of people who participated. It wasn't a very profitable exercise, and the options dealers loved it. I mean, the amount of turnover even today is far higher than it was, and it's just it's a casino, basically, because your expected return is negative, you know, in purchasing calls or puts as an individual investor, for sure, because the bid ask is really wide. I mean, we could discuss, I'm sure you and most of your listeners understand that, but
you know, all the friction is hard to get over.
Don't speculate on options. Don't do it. You know?
Yeah. They say sell vol until you ball. Sell vol, don't buy vol.
Until you ball.
that revolutionary fervor, you sort of say that the revolution wasn't, but I certainly see that revolutionary fervor in lots of other names besides GameStop. I think that the crowd started in GameStop, but they've kind of moved on to other things. And one stock that, I don't know if you follow AMC at all. I don't really follow it closely.
I'm very familiar with the goings on there, yeah.
I find it's such a strange place to have made the stand. Do you know what I mean? Like they're mm-hmm. in there expecting this mother of all short squeezes mm-hmm. to occur at some point. I just don't, it's, I find it a little bit hard to look away. Every time I see it, I want to kind of get an update with what these guys are doing, but that it's the tape in it is terrible. The price is down so much. I don't know. It would really have to be the mother of all, the grandmother of all short squeezes at this point to get back to break even. Do you feel like that's the same attitude, that we're going to stick it to they, whoever they are?
Yeah. Yeah. Except in the case of the mother of all short squeezes, it's based on, like you take two or three facts that are actual facts, you know, some financial information that's available to the public or available for a, you know, a subscription, you know, through FactSet or whatever. And you conflate that with, there are counterfeit shares and these hedge funds haven't closed their positions. For those not au fait with the mother of all short squeezes, also just goes by the acronym MOASS. Go on the internet and do hashtag MOASS and, read away, but don't buy it. So it just takes a few facts that are true and a few conjectures which are not true, and conflates into this, like there's this gigantic payoff that's going to bankrupt all these big hedge funds because they haven't closed their short positions in AMC, which is a movie theater chain. AMC went up a whole bunch during the same time that GameStop went up. There were 7 or 8 stocks, or 13 in all, if you want to really broadly define them, that were meme stocks, but 7 or 8. And what they all had in common was they were all sort of these relics of the recent past, that were really either hurt by their faulty business models or hurt by the pandemic. So you had BlackBerry, the maker, before the iPhone took over, the maker of the leading smartphone maker. You had Bed Bath & Beyond, which was being Amazoned out of business, and that was out of business. You had GameStop, of course, and you had AMC and a few others. You had a wired stereo headset maker and a bunch of other stocks. And what they all had in common was people just did a scan on Yahoo Finance or whatever, and they saw what had very heavy net short interest. And so they started picking on those, and they had tended to have those in common. And AMC was the place where, of course, all these people went to go see all the Avenger movies and whatever. And so that was also a business being put out. But AMC, the difference there was that the people who were in the management of AMC embraced this movement. And so Adam Aron, who is still the CEO of AMC, was really bailed out. They were months away from bankruptcy. They had a bunch of converts that were headed to zero. They had they had taken on very, very unfavorable debt during the pandemic, and they were just kind of breathing their last breaths. And they're not profitable today, but they have been recapitalized to a large extent because of the meme stock traders. And so people ask, how are these businesses? How is GameStop too, to a lesser extent? How are they still going? If they were businesses that were supposed to be going bankrupt? And part of the answer is that they recapitalized themselves. And if you want to talk about it later, we can put Tesla in the same bucket. Tesla,
the equity issuance
3 or 4 years ago. Yeah. I mean, if you have a very high stock valuation, but you're running out of money by making people believe or creating a kind of cult status around your stock and then raising money at that kind of unrealistic valuation, you can do it again and again, and you can turn yourself. It doesn't necessarily make that investment that people made at that very rich valuation a good investment. It usually doesn't, right? If you sell overpriced stock to people, the people who bought the overpriced stock are not going to be happy. Well, they might be in Tesla's case if they sold today, because it turned out to be a good buy. But AMC is the poster child for that. And it's also a poster child, in my opinion, for executives just being in the right place at the right time. Adam Aron, my math might be wrong, but I think he's personally sold about $94 million in stock, either sold or given to relatives, $94 million in stock. He has a lot more to sell. They launched, they got to the point where they couldn't raise more equity because they had no more authorized share capital. They were
we need a board vote
on that front. And so they, with a bit of financial engineering, they launched, and the people who are in the stock are called apes. They call themselves apes. They launched
apes together strong.
Yeah, the apes forever strong. And they launched a preferred stock, which they did have. And the preferred stock, the terms of the preferred stock, the special class of preferred stock, were economically identical to their common stock, but it was preferred, and they could sell much more of that one. And that had the ticker APE. And inexplicably, for a long, long time, APE and AMC traded at a very wide gulf. So Jim Chanos, the short seller, actually, and I'm not sure where that stands today. Let's say APE doesn't exist now, but there was a long period of time where APE and AMC, despite being economic identical, because all the people who owned it didn't know what they were doing, had a very, very wide spread from each other. But that didn't matter. That was all part of the plan to recapitalize the company. And normally you'd think, if you kind of have any kind of fiduciary duty, you have two classes of stock that are economically identical. Am I going to sell and dilute my shareholders by selling the much cheaper version of that equity? Well, it doesn't really seem like a totally upstanding thing to do, but that's what they did, because that was the security that they could sell to stay in business. And now they've unified the two classes of stock. And so there's way more shares outstanding than there were at the time of the meme stock squeeze. And that company, probably will live to fight another day. They have enough stock to keep going. And of course the pandemic is, I guess technically we're still in the pandemic, but the acute emergency phase of the pandemic is over and people are going to movie theaters again. And so the real cash crunch period is behind them. But it's a crazy story. With many crazy chapters. MOAS. I mean, look it up and don't, don't take it too seriously,
careful.
but it's
Yeah, those searches.
I get a lot of hate mail whenever I kind of raise it in a tweet or in an article.
I didn't know they could read
the Wall Street Journal and sister publications. If they write about it, you know, they kind of get cyber bullied basically by people who sort of, I don't know. I think it's not nice, but it's kind of the QAnon of finance, I guess, is what someone called it. And I think that's not,
that's not far wrong.
Too.
One of the other sort of interesting things that happened through that period was anytime a company went into bankruptcy and it got the Q on the end of it, it was like the, like a seal
moon.
Of approval. Yeah. It was like when Hertz got the Q, it went absolutely bananas. Did you follow Hertz?
The crazy thing there is because it had happened before. So imagine, I mean, you're a young person and you heard about a friend or a friend of a friend, or you read online someone who doubled or quadrupled their money when the stock got the Q, and not all Qs are created equal, right? There are some stocks in bankruptcy where there is some recovery where you can make money if you have a very sophisticated understanding.
Is Q for quality? Is that what the...
No, I don't think that oh, that's... Okay. I think that might not be it. But obviously, there are many companies where it is very clear that you're not going to recover anything, that you're this thing still trades, but you're not going to make money. But it doesn't matter. If you bought it at a buck and sold it at $2, you made 100%. And the poor guy, the kind of the greater fool who bought it at $2, maybe he or she sold it at $3 and made 50%, and so on and so forth until someone got left holding the bag. And so the fact that someone, it's just like someone winning the lottery, you know, it's mathematically, I think the vast majority of people, it's not right to call the lottery a tax on enumeracy. Because I think most people understand that the expected return of a lottery ticket, a Powerball ticket, is negative, right? But they still buy it because they read about someone who made a lot of money and they want to dream and they think that they'll
hope.
Be lucky this time. And so I think that kind of greater fool, and that is the kind of saddest thing, you know, about this this whole episode and all the kind of echoes of it, is that the young people who have gotten into investing, I view it as a good thing because young people were not interested enough in investing and having brokerage accounts and starting 401ks or IRAs or what have you before this. And now they got into investing, but too many of them view this, first of all, they view it as a kind of get rich quick and kind of greater fool theory, which is obviously not the path to riches. It's a, you're going to be a net loser as a group doing that, right? Because you do need a greater fool. And the greater fool is, you know, when things are really elevated, is definitely going to be coming from that cohort. It's not going to be coming from some hedge fund. So you're, you know, you need someone to lose in order for you to have that walk away with that gain. But the other thing is that there are all these MOAS and other conspiracy theories where they blame some shadowy cabal of being behind their losses rather than their own stupidity and greed. And then they just get disgusted with investing with Wall Street. And what's the most expensive thing? You know, if you lose $500 or $1,000 when you're 23 years old, it's not that big of a deal. You lost $1,000. So what? It's in terms of tuition, you know, that's pretty cheap. You know, if you kind of wake up, and I do know people, and you probably do know people too, who made dumb financial and investing mistakes and said, you know what, I'm going to just be kind of follow the straight and narrow and maybe buy a book or watch and acquire multiple podcast or whatever and understand. Understand what the long-term formula is for success over decades, right? That's a good thing, but that's unfortunately, it's going to be a small minority of the people who got caught up in this thing. I think also a small minority get wrapped up, and it's a really small vocal group of people who believe in MOAS and what have you and think it's a conspiracy. I don't think that's that many people either. I mean, tens of thousands, maybe, you know, who are really obsessed with this. And the remainder, I think, are just going to be disillusioned and say the stock market is rigged and it's not for me. And I'm going to, I don't know, buy cryptocurrency or not save or not set up an account. And that, you know, measured over decades is going to cost them a lot of money, right? The fact that they're not you know, multiplying their wealth. You can add up your wealth. You can put your money in a bank account, and you know, addition will only get you so far. It's multiplication that gets you a big nest egg, and compounding, and they're going to forego that, which is really a shame, right? And so that I think is the kind of the saddest, most expensive outcome of this ethos that emerged the last few years among the newest investors.
What do you think about naked shorting?
Well, so naked shorting became much more difficult. Naked shorting, to be clear, is shorting a stock without locating a borrow. So you can sell a stock short pretty easily, but you need to, if you're a hedge fund or whoever, you need to locate a borrow. And there was not a lot of naked shorting that went on during this episode because it has become much more difficult because of regulation SHO. But naked shorting did occur, and it happened because of something I don't want to bore you, put your viewers to sleep, but the details, something called rehypothecation, which is that imagine that, you know, you have a hedge fund and you located a borrow and you shorted a stock that you thought was going to go down in value. You sold it to someone. There's a buyer on the other side. And that buyer has it in their brokerage account, and their broker then says, hey, there's some stock shares here, and this stock with a, you know, that I can make a lot of money lending out, I'm going to lend it out to someone else, and it gets lent out twice. And so that's how you get to 140% net short. Shouldn't happen, but it does. It's not a shadowy conspiracy. But of course it shouldn't happen. It's kind of a clerical issue more than anything, than a kind of an evil plot to drive shares to zero. And again, I just want to emphasize that if you find a company that's overvalued or perhaps fraudulent, or there's a lot of red flags about it, and you sell it short, you're not destroying the company. You are making a bet against the company. It's two different things. But as a matter of fact, there's a great study that came out in the early 2000s. I apologize, I'm forgetting the author's name. It's an academic study saying that executives who complain about short sellers, including naked short sellers, those are excellent stocks to short. The odds of a company like that going bankrupt. And there's a great story, and I verified that this is true, that Dick Fuld was given a copy of this academic paper by someone and just said, this is bullshit, and kind of said, don't show me this, you know. But you know, we all know how that ended. So, you know, companies that complain about short sellers are maybe not in the short run, because they, you know, obviously they can, you know, you can lose your shirt in the short run, but in the long run tend to be good companies to bet against, or like poor stocks to buy. Let's put it that way.
The research is pretty clear that you don't want to be short things that are too heavily shorted, because you're competing for the short. It's a crowded short, and you're going to pay a lot. And that's one of we have a comment here that says that one of the reasons that the AMC APE spread remained so wide was that the short lending cost was very high. Evidently, to get.
I mean, I spoke to and quoted Jim Chanos for a piece that I wrote. So I didn't follow it over the, I guess, more than a year that it was outstanding, or maybe not more than a year, but the many, many months it was outstanding and was a security. It was, the cost to borrow was like 20-something%, so not astronomical at that time, but it could have changed. And yeah, it probably was difficult to short. And 23% is pretty high, given that. During the meme stock squeeze, a typical stock would have cost you less than 1%, you know, to short in terms of cost to borrow. That's when interest rates were zero, of course.
There's a question here. Did they change how the short interest report? There has been a change to how shorts are reported. I'm not sure. Do you know, Spencer, what's happened there?
There was a proposed change. I don't think there was any rule change. I think the SEC. Of course, the SEC comes out of this, and they, you know, who do you blame, you know, for the episode? You blame short sellers for the episode, which is, I think they really should have looked elsewhere. They did also look elsewhere, but the kind of reports that came out of it said, well, we need to reform the way that short selling happens, and there needs to be fuller reporting of short positions, even small short positions. I don't think that the rule changed, although I'm not an expert on market regulation. But yeah, I mean, obviously you have to be much more careful, and you have to be much more cognizant of what's happening on social media. If you're short a stock that where there's heavy short interest, first of all, you obviously, as you said, you should not it's very dangerous to short a stock where a lot of people have noticed the same thing you did and sold it short, because, you know, Keynes didn't say it, but he's widely quoted as saying the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. And that holds true. I mean, your losses are capped at infinity for a short sale. And your gain, your maximum gain is 100%. So it's a very asymmetric payoff. And you need to be really, really careful about what you're doing. Even if you're Gabe Plotkin and it's just one, you know, not particularly huge short position within a very large, I think the fund was $13 billion at the time. And the market value, the summer of 2020, the market value of all of GameStop was a few hundred million dollars.
I wasn't aware that Keynes hadn't said that, but now that you say that he hadn't said that, it doesn't sound, he would never have said anything in fewer than 50 words. I don't think he wrote a sentence.
No,
it wasn't a run on sentences
in
his entire life.
That's how you know. Always,
if you, you know, keep a copy of Bartlett's familiar quotations, there are a lot of things that people didn't say. I mean, they're great. Someone said them, but not them.
JT, have you got veggies there? Was that our veggies earlier?
No, I've got something.
Spencer, we serve vegetables every time we do this. We have some dessert later, but vegetables are the learning portion of the okay. podcast that Jake delivers.
So this week's veggies are on Batesian mimicry. And this is another segment that I pulled from that book, What I Learned About Investing from Darwin by Pulak Prasad. And so Batesian mimicry is when a harmless species has evolved to imitate the warning signals of a harmful species, mm-hmm. and it's typically directed at a predator that would be trying to eat them. And it's named after this English naturalist named Henry Walter Bates, after he worked on butterflies in the rainforest of Brazil and for over a decade, like from 1848 to 1858. And actually, the first 4 years that he was working there, he was there with Alfred Russel Wallace, who was kind of famously co-discovered but doesn't get as much credit as Darwin for natural selection. So anyway, Bates collected all of these, you know, 100 butterflies, and while he's sorting them, he discovers that some looked alike, but they actually weren't even closely related at all. And so it was kind of a bit of a mystery there. And he put forward the hypothesis that, you know, close resemblance between unrelated species was this anti-predator adaptation. And, you know, he noted that, you know, some showed very striking coloration and they flew around leisurely, almost as if they were taunting predators to eat them, which is kind of funny. But, you know, the birds were basically like reasoned that these butterflies were unpalatable based on the color and avoided them. And so basically they were parasitizing these signals that were honest signals from another particular species, so that they, you know, this Batesian mimicry gained them an advantage without having to actually go to the expense of arming themselves with poison or, you know, the toxicity or whatever that might be expensive to create. So, and maybe the best known example of this is the milk snake that looks like the deadly coral snake, but it's actually harmless, right? And it can also be used for attraction. So apparently, you know, these large male green frogs will advertise their size and dominance by croaking at a lower frequency than smaller frogs. And that's probably just has to do with like the size of them and the vibration. But and then female frogs will be attracted to these, you know, low frequencies. And smaller frogs have now have evolved the ability to copy that low frequency of the bigger frogs. And like they'll preserve their territory by fooling larger males from even coming in and also, you know, attracting mates. And I was thinking, you know, maybe the like super lifted trucks is the human form of Batesian mimicry of pretending that you're a macho man. Anyway, and it also sometimes doesn't work out so well for one party. There's a certain species of fireflies that the females mimic the mating signals of another species, and they'll deceive the males into coming close enough, and then they'll eat them. Then to add to our story here, 1975, an Israeli evolutionary biologist named Amors Zahavi, I believe is how it's pronounced. And he proposed this concept called the handicap principle. And his hypothesis was that a signal that is costly to produce, the receiver can then interpret that it's actually an honest trade and isn't Bayesian mimicry, basically. So mm-hmm. the Peacock is kind of a classical example of this, right? It's very expensive to have this large, colorful tail that attracts a lot of attention from predators. But what it, the females see that, and they see it as a sign of biological fitness, and then they want to mate with that male. So, so let's, what can we do? Think about this in the world of investing in business. Like, what can we draw from this? And Prasad says that, you know, we should only look and give credence to those signals from companies, which are actually costly to produce. So you mm-hmm. think about press releases, you know, talk tends to be pretty cheap there. Like management can highlight whatever they want. They can spin it how they want. Management interviews as well are pretty comparable to that. You know, there's lots of bromides and talking points, and rarely is it costly for them to point out, you know, what would actually you might consider an honest signal. Like every company is innovating, every company is leveraging technology, right? Like, but what does that
AI?
Yeah, exactly. That's all cheap, right? You know, conferences and road shows that they show up to, not really much different. So what about like earnings guidance? This one's kind of interesting. Like, you know, the worst case is probably, you know, Jack Welch and his time at GE, where they had slush funds that were basically used so they could hit earnings right up to the penny. But there was a McKinsey study that came out about earnings guidance, and it found that there's no evidence that providing earnings guidance affects valuation multiples, shareholder returns, or share price volatility. The only significant effect that it found, and this kind of ties in, Spencer, some of the things you were talking about, the, you know, churn, is that it increases trading volumes. So the brokers are kind of the only ones who win in this thing.
Right.
So true, honest signals then, like what can we look for that? Like it tends to be more historical, like them telling you something history, like our average margin over the last 10 years was 12%, or based on recent history, we've launched one product over the last 3 years, instead of we're going to do six projects in the next year, right? But what have you done historically? Mm-hmm. And probably the most honest statements and signals come from the proxy statement. Mm-hmm. That's where you find skin in the game. This is like might look at some of Mike Nongap's dark arts things that he's written up, if you want to search for that. You know, how's management incentivized? What are their salaries? What KPIs are they tied to? Are they sandbagging? You know, what do the equity grants look like and the stock price for their options? How's the board ensuring that talent is retained and incentivized, especially if their existing options are underwater, which is kind of a more recent phenomenon. And two, special things that might you look out for, especially are what are called like spring loading and then bullet dodging. And they're kind of the same thing, but opposite sides. Spring loading is when you grant options right before there's a big positive news event. And then bullet dodging is when you delay to grant options until after a negative news event has happened and you kind of like sandbag and torpedo the stock price potentially. And both are, you know, kind of fall within a gray area, I think, as far as insider trading goes. But doesn't seem to be high up on the SEC's list of things to worry about. But anyway, those are, you know, Batesian mimicry in the investment world, I think happens a lot where people, you know, they'll talk like, you know, talking like the Outsiders book, you know, they'll mm-hmm. pretend to be iconoclastic, but where does it actually show up? Like, what are the real signals that are costly for them to produce, not just talk? And looking for those and trying to separate out costly from not costly will help you to understand, you know, when are you dealing with the milk snake versus the coral snake?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I mean, this is obviously doesn't really apply to the meme stocks and things like that, but I feel like what's really precious, and I apologize, my dog is barking. He won't stop if I ask him to stop barking. Is what a company does with its cash and does consistently with its cash. I mean, mm-hmm. cash is precious. You can't print it. You can print up more shares. You can't print up more cash. And so companies that act in a very, very consistent way in terms of their capital structure, I think tend to be some of the best companies. I'm thinking two off the top of my head, Costco and AutoZone that I've observed that they are very, very consistent at not expanding too quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Not empire building, having a very consistent degree of leverage, a very consistent cash payout, you know, kind of shareholder yield between buybacks and dividends, and they don't vary it. They don't try to time the market. You know, you can people. I just find one of the dumbest things that people will say is this company did stock buybacks last year when the share price was 90 and now the share price is 60. And as a shareholder, I'm outraged that they wasted money. Like, well, you were a shareholder at 90. You didn't see that the stock was going to go to 60. And why didn't you sell if you had, you know, if you felt that way? I mean, hindsight is 20/20. I mean, we do know that companies are very poor market timers, right? I mean, they're
counter-cyclical.
Totally. I mean, it is unfortunately, it's counter-cyclical and, well, mutual fund investors and everything else. I mean, it's all like, you know, should zig when they're zagging. So I don't think the companies, that's the bad thing about buybacks, whereas like financially, it's very similar to a dividend, except you're not committing yourself. You know, you really, it's an embarrassing climb down if you cut your dividend. Whereas if you sort of just quietly halt buybacks or a program comes to an end or whatever, it's totally at your discretion. And so companies tend to make bad choices. But I mean, those companies that are very consistent, like across a cycle in terms of, you know, how they deploy cash, which they can't create. You know, I think those are the ones that kind of have skin in the game, you know, and then also, and then just AutoZone, I don't know, Costco, one of the more surprising things as a financial journalist that ever happened to me was when I was writing Ahead of the Tape, it was this daily investing column in the Wall Street Journal that doesn't exist anymore. It was in the front of the money and investing section for many years. I was the guy who wrote it every day. And I wrote about all kinds of companies and Costco came up and I wasn't very familiar with Costco. And so in the process of researching it, writing up there, you know, what their results were going to mean and look like, I called up the company. There was a number at the bottom of the press release. And the guy who picked up the phone, I took me a few minutes to realize I was talking to the CFO, like no secretary. Oh,
is it Jim Senegal? You're just chatting with him on the
retailer in the US. I mean, that's, first of all, he was very helpful and candid, but also he picked up his own phone and spent time speaking with me. And you know, what better sign do you need than that? And so, you know, it's like another one of those kind of intangibles. Like you go to their headquarters and it's not very nice and the furniture is not very good and it's not in a great part of town. And they didn't really, you know, they don't have like a lot of perks. They're spending the money on the parts of the business that matter. I mean, those are signals as well. You know, if you know what to look for, doesn't always work.
And those are actually costly.
Those things mean something to me.
Management's flying coach. Like that's a cost to them, you know? And so those are the signals you should probably keep an eye on.
Yeah. Right, Veggies, JT. Buybacks is a good example because more buybacks are announced than are completed because people know that you get a little bounce when you announce a buyback and then, you know, it's free. You don't have to go and complete the buyback. You've already got the bounce that you wanted. And then looking back historically, that's the best measure. Who has bought back a material sum of shares over the last, whatever, 1, 3, 5 years and is undervalued. But you make a good point, Spencer. If you knew at 90 that it was going down, you should have sold if you're unhappy with the buyback at that level. It's unknowable.
I mean, there's a lot of scope to complain, right? There are a lot of companies that did buybacks when times were good.
Yeah.
And then halted them when times were bad. And they should be, in theory, doing the opposite. But if you do it consistently, or if you have you know, very mechanical criteria for doing it, that's the best approach. And that applies to investing too, in my opinion. I mean, if you, you know, not a professional investor, but if you're an individual investor, I always tell my friends and neighbors who don't get bored of hearing about it, you know, if you have a certain mix of risky and less risky assets that you feel comfortable holding in the long run, and the stock market has had a great year, then circle the date on the calendar and rebalance on that date. I mean, of course, there are funds that will do this for you, but rebalance on that date, no matter what, no matter what the headlines say, no matter how good or bad the headlines are on that day, that's the day you're going to do it. And you're going to be a lot of times acting as a contrarian. But I mean, the results of doing that and being unemotional and being mechanical, do pay off in the long run, because it takes your personal bias out of it.
Preaching to the choir here.
Yes, I was gonna say preach.
When you're, how do you source for herd on the street? How do you find out what's happening? What's the
well,
mechanism?
Well, so I used to write for the Lex column, which is a very similar column at the Financial Times, where it's scrupulously off the record. You might quote, let's say, a company executive said this, or President Biden said that, or Janet Yellen said this, but you don't you don't quote anyone you spoke with. We're a reported column. You can speak with people, you can cite an expert, although we often don't. And there are a lot of people, a lot of smart people who want to speak with us on background. And you know, you distill what they told you and what you've read, and you'd have to do your own analysis as well. We're an opinion, financial opinion and analysis column. So we, you know, you have to know how to read a balance sheet. You have to know something about the industry that you're writing about. You have to have some kind of deep level of familiarity, something approaching what an analyst is. And that was my first career, was being a stock analyst, but not to the same level of detail. And I think there's an advantage there because, first of all, when you're an analyst, analysts are very bad at picking stocks and telling you, you know, their buy, sell, and hold recommendations don't work out well, in part because you have to go through a whole process to change your recommendation, but also you don't want to embarrass yourself in front of management. You want to curry favor with them, but also because you missed the forest for the trees. You know, you're so close to the subject matter. You know, when I was an analyst, you know, I have a pretty good memory for numbers, and you know, somebody said, what was that company's you know, EBIT 2 years ago? I could have told you. But is that a very useful piece of information to have at instant recall? Well, not really. You know, you need to be able to see the big picture and have spoken to their competitors and have some sense of what's going on in the world and industry trends. And analysts spend so much mental energy, you know, with getting those granular details that they tend to miss the big picture. Whereas a columnist, like a Heard on the Street columnist, can, you know, you might not have the same depth, but you're broad enough that you can see, sometimes spot things well ahead of Wall Street.
If you're not sourcing in the column, do you require, but someone has said something to you, you have to, what are the ethics of that situation? You have to have that noted somewhere that's acknowledged that this is a genuine source, so you can avoid Stephen Glass or whatever his name was, had the juked Micronics.
Yeah. Look, I mean, you're speaking, first of all, we can quote people, we can quote sources. We say Bank of America analyst wrote this, said this, the executive in a conversation with the CEO in a conversation with us said this thing. They also can say, this is on background. Let me explain the situation to you. And that can inform our take. And you can take out your bullshit meter and say, well, this person's telling me this thing on background, does not want to be quoted. How credible is it? How is it, you know, I'm going to not take their word for it. I'm going to cross-check that with what I'm hearing from others, and then I'm going to write what I write. So there are a lot of background conversations that can play into a column. I mean, we don't have, I mean, I think what you're talking about is a case of someone making up sources, which we just can't do, right? I mean, making up quotes, making up sources, that can pretty quickly be found out in a high profile publication. I'm not aware of that.
Save that for Twitter.
Happened. you know, so that's not a danger. And then of course we don't own, I mean, I personally, because I edit the column in addition to writing, you know, I don't own any individual stocks because anything could potentially be a conflict of interest. So as much as I'd like to, everyone wants to think they're very clever and can
kind
be
of a bummer,
really great stock picker. And so I only own stocks virtually. I don't own stocks for real. I make all kinds of bets with people about this is going to go down and this is going to go up and play stock games and things like that. But I just ETFs and mutual funds and stuff like that. So I don't think there's a lot of danger in the way that we approach things. It's very ethical, in particular with the Wall Street Journal. I mean, I think journalists generally are ethical, but I think we have very, very strict ethics rules at the journal. I can't accept bus fare from a company to go talk to them. I need to pay my, you know, I mean, the journal will compensate me if I get on a plane and go somewhere, but they can't put me up in a hotel or anything like that.
My limited experience in this was with Jason Zweig, and I couldn't believe the amount of background digging that he did before publishing anything. I mean, it was very impressive.
Yeah, Jason is great. He's amazing. He's like a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. It's great to just, I mean, you don't want to bother him because he's just doing such important stuff. But I mean, if you have a question right. about anything investing or securities related, you know, you could walk over to him, and he's just such a generous soul, and will know. He doesn't even have to look it up. You know, he'll know it. You know, he'll remember it. You know, he's like a walking encyclopedia. He's great.
That's coming up on time, Spencer. The name of the book is The Revolution That Wasn't. Spencer Jacobson, Penguin Random House. Is that right? It's a combined.
That's the publisher, yeah. And Portfolio is the imprint. Yep.
And Portfolio. Spencer, thanks so much for joining us this week. JT, as always. And folks, we'll be back next week. Same bat time.